Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, the Reverend Mark Tyler of Mother Bethel AME Church weighs in on the Derek Chauvin trial. Also, we catch up to the Philly sports scene with the Inquirer's Marcus Hayes. But to begin, federal stimulus money will go a long way toward breathing new life into Philadelphia's battered finances. Mayor Kenney has proposed using hundreds of millions of dollars in aid to shore up the fiscal 2022 budget, avoiding painful cuts and instead preserving or reestablishing many programs, including restorative justice, street sweeping, libraries, city pools, and arts and culture. The plan would also borrow tens of millions of dollars for capital projects, including improvements to commercial corridors, FDR Park, street paving, and more. And the wage tax would continue to decline, albeit slightly. And the proposal keeps funding to the city police budget at its current level, despite calls from many activists to defund or reduce funding to the police department. Philadelphia Councilmember Maria Quiñones-Sanchez is chair of the Appropriations Committee on City Council, and she's with us now on the roundup to share her reaction and thoughts. Welcome back, Maria.
Good morning. Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Sure. You're quoted as saying this budget is a safe budget, meaning what?
Well, it means that it goes back to what we all said was the old normal, that was not equitable and really did not have some of the rethinking and reimagining the government needs to do in order to protect some of the most vulnerable constituencies while ensuring a more equitable recovery for the city of Philadelphia. So when you look at all the numbers, it looks like we're investing on all the right things, but we're structurally not changing what we were doing pre-pandemic.
So when you say reimagining, tell us more about that thought process.
Well, I think one of the things that we all have seen through the pandemic is that Philadelphia's poverty rate is going to be one of those issues that unless we structurally deal with it and make investments in people, not just programs, that we're not going to move the needle and really haven't moved that rate significantly. So, for example, when we talk about homeless prevention or supporting people through some of the housing instability, we're getting quite a bit of more money, but we're still investing it in programs that even the federal government had said is too expensive. Things like transitional housing, which could cost us about $50,000 per family and take us a couple of years, at that rate, we could almost buy people homes. So it's, again, we fail to reimagine. Another example would be the police department. I think so everybody was looking at a more innovative approach to policing. We moved crossing guards out of the police department. We should be moving traffic duties. We have to reimagine the police department. We need them focused on high crimes and those issues, not what everybody sees and gets frustrated when we see a police car guarding a construction site or doing traffic duties that could be done and have been discussed about us having a civilian traffic duty officer versus police officer. So again, we fail to use the COVID reality to say, no, we're going to do things significantly different.
This budget does keep funding for the police department at about the current level, the $727 million, I believe. So, and Maria, as we all well know, following last year's social justice protests, there have been calls from activists to defund the police department. Your thoughts on funding or reshaping, please? I mean, you just talked a little bit about reshaping, but funding.
Yeah, I think that there are many duties within the police department that we've assigned to the police department that we should reimagine and move. Traffic is the one that I explained.
Right.
We have the police department responding. I think when you look at areas like Kensington that I represent, there's two departments people count on, streets department and the police department, and that hasn't made Kensington safer. So you see incremental investments in, for instance, the forensic, which we have talked about countless hours, the need to modernize and improve our, you know, investigation process so that we can get to better cases and more convictions. So you see a very slight incremental investments in that, not the kind of transformation that you want. When we talk about training, right, de-escalation, tasers, all of the different conversations that had, again, in those things, you see the department just hitting them in the margins and not saying we're going to rethink how we do this.
So you say
what you're going to have. Frustrated people. We're going to have a lot of frustrated people because we have the police department doing and focusing on the work that is not going to lead to a safer streets.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, it's reshape the police department, but not necessarily take dollars away from police funding.
No, I think we need to take certain tasks totally away from them. Last year, we removed the crossing guards, for instance, from the police department budget. We felt like, and I think we need to do that as it relates to traffic duties and the police department, babysitting construction sites. I think we have to reimagine it differently. And those are the things that frustrate people, right? When they see, 24-hour police protection of a construction site, someone else could be doing that work.
And the monies that fund those services when that would then be spent elsewhere in the police department. Okay, so $13 million would go to gun violence reduction, enough to make a difference in the city of Philadelphia, which is in the middle of a gun violence crisis.
It is not, because it really does not look at some of our grant and our other prevention programs. We have hundreds of millions of dollars that go towards programs for prevention, after school programming, all those other things. When you say $13 million in the middle of a crisis, it really, again, fails to reimagine what is this summer, spring and summer going to look like for young people? $13 million is not going to move the needle significantly. Yes, are we going to fund non-traditional groups who've been doing the work out there? Absolutely. But what does that mean for the 100 buildings that we're going to open for the school district? What kind of programming are we going to have in those schools? What are we going to be doing at the rec centers to ensure that our 13 to 17-year-olds who are getting shot at really have spaces to go to and be safe post-pandemic? $13 million is not going to do that. It means we have to look at our Health and Human Services budget, which totaled $3 billion, and say we're going to make sure we're investing in programs and people. And that is not the case.
Speaking of children and summertime, how did the closing of public pools last summer during the pandemic affect kids and families in your district? And does this budget make up for that loss?
Well, I mean, we are encouraged by the school district's response and the fact that the federal government has stipulated that the school district money has to cover what they call the educational COVID gap that has existed because of virtual learning. And so they're going to be opening up schools, but we need to do academic and enrichment activities as well as, keep children safe this summer. And how that looks, we have yet to really hear of a comprehensive plan. Just this morning, I was talking to members of the Education Committee and saying, how do we make sure that we have as many activities as possible, given the fact that the school district for 11th, 12th graders not coming back to school, what are we going to do outside of summer employment opportunities, which we've invested and we've doubled down and invested more money? What other things are going to be available for them? And I think that we have yet to really hear a comprehensive plan. Are we doing safe streets and outdoor activities in communities where we know are hot pockets and kids are getting shot at? What are we going to do different? Again, going back to pre-pandemic programming and programming that clearly it wasn't addressing this crisis, the trauma, is not going to move us in a more positive direction. So again, we're tinkering around the edges, not structurally changing how we think about this, and not really addressing what does the trauma inform programming to help young people through this crisis look like. And so we haven't heard that yet. We hope to hear it in the budget conversations around programming. Mm-hmm. But again, the amount of money and investment that we're seeing as added enhancements going back and doing the same thing is not going to change the result that we're seeing in our streets.
Let's talk about some quality of life issues. A citywide street sweeping program is back on the table. How important is a clean environment to the health of a community?
Well, again, all of us are encouraged to see us really doubling down and saying we have to do this cleanup. But there's a couple of other things that are even more important than the street cleanup, right? How we address the fact that people are home And in certain communities where we have density and increased poverty, how are we making sure that we're investing in the department so that we can do, for instance, in neighborhoods like Kensington, where mm-hmm. we know we have 400 folks living in the street, daily trash pickups, more consistent pickups. So the street cleaning is a step in the right direction, but what are we doing about bulk trash? You know, we have our exchange centers open, but, you know, we are picking up and dumping is at an all-time high because we've eliminated the programs that we had from the 80s and the 90s where we did bulk trash pickup and some of the other things. So again, not going into doing this without looking at dumping and all the other issues that we have will clean certain areas for a certain amount of time. Those of us who live along transportation centers and others, we know that the increase in trash, a targeted cleaning program is not going to be enough.
So the budget also proposes cuts to Philly's business and wage taxes. They're not sizable cuts. The Chamber of Commerce says it's supporting this. Many progressives are not, saying this will take money from important programs. Your thoughts here?
Well, you know, I've done a lot of work on all of the business tax reform measures that we currently are employing in the city of Philadelphia. That is the work that I did back in 2010, 11, and 12 when we demonstrated that multinational companies and people doing business in the city of Philadelphia don't pay their fair share. Our tax structure needs to be revisited, and wage tax reductions are important, and we want to move away from dependency around out of city workers. But I would argue, and what we've seen nationally, is that big companies made a whole lot of money during COVID. Walmart, Target, all those big businesses, mm-hmm. because of our tax structure and our dependency on the net profits tax, we penalize local businesses and we allow these big multinationals to use quick accounting tricks not to pay into the market. So this is about reducing the taxes of the people that are overburdened, not capturing unrealized taxes from people in our market. So that is what's missing in this. And, you know, in 2011 and 2012, we talked about it and we showed that multinational companies are not paying their fair share in our market. Philadelphia, Detroit, New York, and Washington, D.C.s are the only ones that have this great dependency on this net profits tax. COVID has demonstrated that these companies are making billions more and not paying more to our local economy.
Okay. We're up against the clock, unfortunately. Some positives in this budget, restoration of funds to libraries, summer pools, and also there's going to be work in capital projects to improve commercial corridors. All thumbs up, in your opinion?
All of those are important if they're done through an equitable lens, which the administration has committed to do. And we will see, you know, the proof will be in the details. We need to structurally invest in the corridors in the neighborhoods that people relied on in COVID, during COVID, even more so. And we need to make sure that the business recovery is more equitable for Black and Brown businesses. You know, we still don't have a gauge of how many of those businesses we lost through the pandemic and through some of the social unrest. So again, very incremental still in terms of investment. I applaud the Chamber of Commerce for some of the work it's doing around making sure that there's more access to capital, because
we're going to have to, unfortunately, we're going to have to jump in. Maria Quiñones Sanchez, so good to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
All right, stay close. The roundup continues in just a moment.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. The nation waits on tenterhooks as the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin enters its final stages. Closing arguments begin today. Chauvin has pleaded not guilty to charges of second-degree unintentional murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter in the killing last May of George Floyd, a horrific death caught on video which sparked the massive social justice protests and movement over the last year. At the same time, protests and conflict continue in the shooting death of Dante Wright, killed during a traffic stop 1 week ago by an officer who says she thought she was deploying a taser. And in Chicago, an investigation continues into the shooting death of 13-year-old Adam Toledo by a police officer in late March. It has been a week fraught with anger and tension, emotions that will likely grow in magnitude as these various stories play out. For perspective on the effect these killings are having on many in the Black community and elsewhere, we are joined now by the Reverend Mark Kelly Tyler, pastor of Mother Bethel AME Church in Philadelphia. Reverend Tyler, it's always good to have you with us.
Well, thank you. Good morning, Mary.
Good morning. And also, here's the number for anyone who'd like to join the conversation, 888-477-9499. You can send an email to radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Reverend Tyler, I'd like to begin by talking about how members of Mother Bethel AME Church and also members of the local community are reacting to all that's been going on. What are you hearing?
Well, that's a question. I mean, my members are like, you know, people all around the country. The emotions are very raw in this moment. I'm watching the social media feed of, you know, members of the congregation who are posting about not only the Chauvin trial, but also about Brooklyn Center, posting about Chicago and just the various ways that this is hitting them. And I mean, this spans the entire, you know, we're a multi-generational congregation. So, you know, these are members in their 70s and 80s, all the way down to, you know, our teenagers who are all wrestling with this and really a genuine lack of feeling safe from people that are supposed to protect you.
Let's get to the trial of Derek Chauvin. Your thoughts about the proceedings thus far?
Well, my God, I mean, listen. I'm old enough to have, you know, been a young adult during the Rodney King trial, the trial of the officers who beat Rodney King and the aftermath and all of that. In fact, I was in seminary training to go to my first church as a pastor. So I started pastoring in the wake of that, you know. And at that moment, we thought then with the video evidence that it was inconceivable how any jury could allow those officers to get, you know, to be found not guilty. Since that moment, you know, since they're being found not guilty, I think there is a deep cynicism within the Black community and those who support the Black community for, you know, these issues, that even in spite of everything that we have seen, I mean, the prosecution has been masterful in the way they've conducted themselves with the one, I think, big mistake around the carbon monoxide testimony. Hmm. But aside from that, they have really delivered, I think, a compelling case. They have shredded the defense argument around he is feared for his life or that's Chauvin, that is, or that these were pre-existing conditions. And so even with all of that, Mary, I mean, there is this deep pessimism that somehow this man is going to get off just like everyone else in killing George Floyd. And if he's convicted, that somehow we'll find out about some new diversionary program instead of jail, but that somehow justice will be once again, you know, taken away from the community. So it's with that feeling that people are deeply apprehensive.
So this is how people are feeling. Do you think that with the social justice advancements and all the airtime and everything we've been watching and kind of understanding and moving toward over the last year, do you think that things truly haven't changed, that there is a real likelihood that Mr. Chauvin won't be convicted of one of the charges?
Well, so listen, I understand the cynicism. Now, personally, I think he'll be convicted, and I do think he'll go to jail. If for no other reason, the fear that those jurors have that their decision will literally send the country up in flames again. I don't know how that does not weigh on a juror in
sure.
this moment.
Sure.
And, you know, and if you didn't carry the weight of that before, my God, after last week, they're not sequestered, so they know what's going on in their own backyard. Brooklyn Center is 10 miles away from where they're deliberating. They know what's happening in Chicago and other places. They see people boarding up. You know, Philadelphia's not the only city boarding up right now. I mean, I went down Spring Garden today, and I mean, businesses are boarded up. They must feel the weight of that. And the question they have to ask themselves is, given what this guy did, you know, do you still let him walk and run the risk as well of letting the country go up in flames? I don't think so. I think he's convicted. But that does not mean that there has been some deep change within criminal justice and the deferential way that we give police officers a wide berth to conduct themselves. I mean, without video, if we had not had the video of Derek Chauvin leaning on George Floyd's neck for 9 minutes, 29 seconds, we now know, would we even be here right now?
Yeah.
Probably not. It would just, it'd be the same thing that we always hear from district attorneys in these cases. 9 times out of 10, unless you have like a reform-minded DA like here, it would be, oh, it's a tragedy, but not a crime. But it took video and burning cities down across the country to even get us to this place. And it shouldn't be that difficult.
Reverend Tyler, in the event he is acquitted, and of course there's the possibility this might happen, what is your counsel to the community, members of your church and the surrounding community, should the verdict be perceived as less than just?
Stay at home. I mean, really, I was out on the streets last year, every night in the summer, walking with protesters. I was out after the Walter Wallace killing, likewise, and I would just say to my members, stay at home. I mean, that's where you're going to be the most safe. I would rather offer counsel to local governments around this country that if he walks, this is because of the way in which we have created a culture that has said to people that police can never do any wrong, that you must always just simply defer to them, and that there is never a time, even something as egregious as this, that should be an open and closed book, that, you know, that somehow they're just given permission to take the lives of black and brown people. And so if you want to avoid these kind of moments, then we have got to fix the real problem.
So stay at home, but also moving forward, regardless of the verdict. And again, if it's not perceived as just, how do you move forward mentally and emotionally to keep moving forward with social justice issues and evolvement in this country or evolution?
Well, for myself, I just keep doing it, right? I mean, I don't know how you do it. It is very painful. There are times where I think many of us who are in this work feel like we should stop. I was very interested in your conversation before with council member Quiñones Sanchez about the budget, for example. So you know that I work with the group Power Live
Yes.
Free, and our Live Free campaign is about police accountability, gun violence, and mass incarceration. And so we're interested in the mayor's budget. I mean, the budget offers, I think, less than $1 million for the new police oversight board, the CPOC, that is about to, launch. It's laughable. I mean, it is laughable that we're going to spend $60 million over 5 years for trash and rubbish, but we're talking about less than $1 million a year for police accountability and police oversight. That is not the direction we need to go. We need a strong, independent, civilian-led police oversight board or commission in Philadelphia that is funded and that can, bring on trained experts who can get to the bottom of cases like this when they happen in Philadelphia. And so before we put money forward for trash pickup, which I support, by the way, we need to deal with the trash that has been happening, in our communities. And that's the way in which black and brown people have been treated by police officers who go on Facebook and call out death to Islam and much more things like that.
Reverend Mark Kelly Tyler, we struggle, of course, with these police shootings, but there are also the videos which play over and over on the news and the media. And I know we've discussed this with various guests before. There's no argument that transparency is essential. And yet sometimes I watch these, I can barely watch these videos. And I just have to ask, I think about the effect on children and adults in the community of repeatedly seeing these images. What are your thoughts here?
It's painful. I do a morning radio show, and I tell my listeners all the time that I watch the videos so that you don't have to. I know that for some people, it's just too traumatic. They can't watch another video. And so they need people they can trust who can explain to them what is being shown, what is being seen. And, that's real, because it's important that we see it, because nothing is going to change if we keep turning a blind eye toward it. What has happened with all of these high-profile cases, Mary, I can give you names of people. I grew up in East Oakland, California, and I guarantee you almost any black person in any major city in America can give you similar stories, from the 60s, from the 70s, from the 80s. I mean, let's not forget, the Black Panther Party was started a month or two after I was born in Oakland, not far from where I was born, and they were started because of the exact same stories. It was police brutality in Oakland, where they were known as one of the most notorious police departments in the country. And so the difference now is that because of video and because of body cam footage, we are seeing what many people have experienced now for hundreds of years in this country. It is not new, but one of my favorite preachers always says, you have to face it to fix it. And we cannot fix this if we continue to ignore it and deny it. You have to look at it.
Yeah. Reverend Tyler, you know, forgive me for this observation, but it just feels as if my sense is that you're not 100% sure that the killing of George Floyd in 2020 will not mark a major turning point in the way we conduct policing in this country moving forward. Am I wrong in my observation?
Your observation is 100% correct. I mean, I firmly believe that he'll be convicted just because of the fear associated with what will happen if he is not. Not to mention the fact that I think the evidence is overwhelming. And I've never seen a police chief, for example, testify against his or her own cops. And so I think that they've been given an easy job to do. It's just go in, it's an alley-oop, put the ball in, and let's move forward. But does this transform policing in general? And that I am less hopeful about yet. Now, I think that day is coming, but police departments have got to change the ways in which they do things. This is a culture, this blue wall. One thing that really bothers me, Mary, and I think that this is how we'll know when things change. When it is not an outlier to have the police chief come and testify against a cop who has killed a citizen to say he does not represent us. That is not what police do. But up until now, it has been, you know, an officer like that is seen as a snitch within the department. Yeah. And yet the police tell us we can't make cases because the community won't come forward and tell us what they've seen. Well, the community is giving you back what you have demonstrated and modeled. You don't tell on each other, and you have a sworn obligation and are paid to do so. And so until that happens, until good cops, quote unquote, root out bad cops, we're going to continue to be here.
The other major cases in front of us, 20-year-old Dante Wright, shot to death by a police officer in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, a week ago. Protests and conflict with police almost every night since. Officer Kim Potter says she thought she was grabbing her taser, instead drew her gun. She's charged with second-degree manslaughter. Have you gotten your head wrapped around that case? That's a terrible way to phrase the question, but sometimes I find It's difficult to get our heads wrapped around any of this. I mean, where are you on this case, Reverend Tyler?
I mean, listen, obviously, this happened, and I watched the video several times, sadly, but you're talking about 11 seconds or so that I counted from the time that, you know, Dante Wright, you know, left the hold of the officer who was about to handcuff him, ran in the car, and when he was shot. I mean, that is so fast that, you know, that things happened in a split second. And so, you know, on the one hand, I guess, I think anybody could understand, you know, you can kind of get your head around, you don't believe it probably, mm-hmm. but you can at least kind of think, well, you know, things do happen. Maybe she was trying to grab a taser. But I think the bigger question is, if you already know who he is and you know where he's going, right? He's a 20-year-old kid with a bench warrant. Does he look like he's going to flee to a foreign country? I mean, you know, we will get you next time, Dante. You're not, you know, we'll go to your house and wait for you to come home. Where are you possibly going to go? I think what angers so many Black people is that we have also seen other videos. And these are videos of white suspects who have had guns in their hands pointed at police, who have had knives in their hands, you know, swinging wildly at police, who have, you know, used their vehicles to try to run police over. And never once, well, I won't say never, but in most times, they're not no one tries to tase them. No one tries to shoot them. There's the constant, you know, concern for their life, even as they are acting in a way that is endangering the police officer and those around them. And yet, when it comes to Black people, there is an immediate you know, reaction to go for some type of weapon, whether the baton, whether the taser, whether the gun. And I think that is the bigger issue as to whether or not she tried to pull the gun or not. That's yeah. for a court to decide. But why did you have to pull anything when there are three of you? But Dante Wright looked like he may have weighed 125, 150, if I'm being generous.
Yeah. Well, that also brings us to the shooting of 13-year-old Adam Toledo in Chicago at the end of March. I mean, any time a 13-year-old dies, it's just terrible. There is also dissent over what happened and the officer's culpability. Former Philadelphia Police Commissioner Charles Ramsey said on CNN last week he thought the police officer's actions were reasonable because it was less than a second between the time the officer saw the gun allegedly in the child's hand to the moment he shot him. How do we view policing in this sort of circumstance?
Well, see, so listen, we're talking about the Chicago PD. Yeah. You know, one of my favorite authors has written a book. She's former professor at Temple on Crook County, you know, her spinoff of Cook County, and talking about the, you know, just all of the just the despicable things that have happened within the Chicago Police Department. Mm. So you're talking about a department that does not get the benefit of the doubt, and that's well-earned, right? So they have done so much wrong, Laquan McDonald, and so many stories that the community is not feeling, you know, them in any kind of way. And I think because of that, people have already made their assumptions. Now, I watched that video as well, and I have to say that I'm probably out of step with a lot of my friends and colleagues in that, because the image that goes around on social media is with Adam Toledo with his hands up with nothing in them. Mm-hmm. But that is a freeze frame. And if you unfreeze it and go back, as you said, about a second, there, you know, there is clearly a gun in his hand, and it's dropped, and his hands are spinning, going up as he's spinning. In that moment, you're in a dark alley. You don't know you're chasing a 13-year-old. You don't know any of this. You are responding to shots fired. And I will add that we have to remember this is Chicago. And as bad as Philadelphia is with our 500 murders last year, 499, that Chicago is worse. This weekend, a 7-year-old girl was murdered in the car with her father in a drive-thru in Chicago. Yeah. And so this is the context. And so I think everything has to be in that context. And it's so, if you've only seen the still photo, I see why you have so much rage. Yeah. But you owe it to yourself, if you're going to publicly critique it, to watch the video, as painful as it is. And I think that will give you some pause.
So much work to do. Reverend Mark Kelly Tyler, pastor of Mother Bethel AME Church in Philadelphia, great to have you with us. I'm sure we're going to hear from you some more, especially as the Chauvin trial unfolds or the result of the trial. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mary.
Okay, and up next on the regional roundup, on a lighter note, lighter side, we'll talk sports with Marcus Hayes of the Philadelphia Inquirer. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and this is the Regional Roundup. As Philadelphia sports fans well know, it helps to have a cast iron stomach. The first week of the Phillies' 2021 campaign featured an exhilarating streak of wins, including a sweep of the Braves. But then the Phils hit the road and went 1-5 before righting the ship this past weekend against the Cardinals. Thankfully, baseball season is long and it's too early to lose heart. So as we wrap up the show, we're going to take a few minutes to talk about what's working and what's not with this Phillies squad. On a positive note, Sixers are looking pretty good atop the NBA's Eastern Conference. Will they stay that way? Stay there, heading to the playoffs. And Eagles players say they will not attend voluntary on-field workouts next month. Draft is next week. Philadelphia Inquirer sports writer Marcus Hayes joins us once again to weigh in on all this and more. Hi, Marcus.
Good morning. How are you? It's I'm glad to be able to provide a little bit of lighthearted discussion after that stirring and controversial stuff you were talking and necessary stuff you were talking about before.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's a tough week, and you know, sometimes it's just good to talk about something like sports just to take a mental break, because we need it, right?
Well, I'm always good for mental breaks.
Well, thanks, Marcus. All right. Well, I don't know if we're going to get a mental break with the Phillies, actually, if you're a sports fan. I mean, they you know, they really did start with a bang. We were all excited with that first, you know, homestand, excuse me, winning 5 out of 6 against the Braves and the Mets. And then, of course, they went away. They went on the road and did really poorly against the teams they'd just beaten. Back home this past weekend, they took a series against the Cardinals. So they haven't done well on the road, Marcus, in a long time. And I mean, does this continue? I mean, are we seeing that this is another strong possibility for the 2021 season?
Well, I will say a lot of things have been coincidental in my eyes. Some teams don't do well on the road with COVID protocols, being restricted, sort of having to be locked down in your hotel all the time, not being able to sort of see the city. And that's a bigger issue with baseball than anything else, because they're there for 3 or 4 days.
Yeah.
That said, not every team has those issues. But it is an issue last season and this season. And the 2 seasons prior to that, the team just wasn't very good. So I'm not sure that the road issue is as big a deal for the Phillies as it seems like on paper.
Okay. Well, they are largely playing, because of COVID, an intradivisional regional schedule, correct?
Correct, yes.
So that does this mean we're going to see a lot of the Braves and the Mets? And are the Phillies, if this is so, are the Phillies up for the task?
Well, and that's the other thing that you sort of have to grade on a curve. The fact that the Phillies are competitive with the Braves and the Mets going through, you know, what, 2.5 weeks now, is cause for celebration if you're a Phillies fan, because those are two really good teams.
Yeah.
You know, the Phillies on paper aren't nearly as good as the Braves or the Mets. But if they can win 90 games playing in the National League East, even if that doesn't get them into the playoffs, that's a heck of a year by the pitching staff. That means that they hit the ball well, and it means that Joe Girardi, the second-year manager, who's really kind of in his first year since they only played 60 games last year, that means he's done a great job.
Bryce Harper's leadership and hustle make the Phillies bearable, the headline on your Friday column. So Harper's not afraid to take his teammates and himself to task. What sort of effect can this have on a club?
Well, when the guy making $330 million both criticizes himself and the team for not playing badly, but playing shabbily, playing irresponsibly, playing unprofessionally or impatiently, that raises everybody's antenna. And the last couple of years, it hasn't been Bryce Harper as much as it has been Rhys Hoskins, who's a much less accomplished and younger player. But I think you're going to see more of that from Bryce Harper and JT Realmuto, the catcher that they kept out of free agency or signed back from free agency, who really is kind of the leader of this team. You know, most teams with a really good catcher, with a strong personality, that person is really kind of the spokesman and leader of the team, because he can talk about the lineup and he can talk about the pitching staff.
So he's worth the money.
Oh, he's underpaid. He's wonderful.
Was he like $115 million for 5 years or something?
Yeah, and he's worth probably another $50. He's carrying the team right now. He's a spectacular defensive catcher. And the thing that, about baseball that I think goes least appreciated is how catchers manage, handle pitching staffs. And he's got the entire spectrum of pitching staff to deal with. He's got relatively successful relievers and starters, 2 stars on the front end in Aaron Nola and Zach Wheeler, and 2 guys who are just hanging on the back end, and Zach Eflin in the middle, who's sort of coming into his own, and that's just the starting rotation. What JT has done with his pitching staff really last year and this year so far is probably his greatest contribution, probably the least noted.
What did you think of Aaron Nola's shutout yesterday against the Cardinals? A gem.
You know, it's funny. It's funny. He pitched a total of 9 innings in his previous 2 starts. My colleague, Bob Brook, over at the Inquirer, wrote a very good column about, well, I believe Aaron Nola is an ace. Look at his numbers compared to other top pitchers. Look at what he's done. Look what he just did. The difference for me between Aaron Nola and an ace is what he just did is more the norm than the exception. And yes, the other pitchers that Bob talked about, from my perspective, are appreciably better, and there has to be a cutoff line somewhere. That said, Aaron Nola is probably underpaid as well, because he's very, very good, and the status of his career when he signed his current contract was such that he wasn't going to get super money. If he continues this sort of performance, even at the level that he's performing, not an ace, but clearly a number one starter, I think that Aaron Nola is going to be the richest pitcher in the history of the Philadelphia Phillies.
Third baseman Alec Bohm's big toe, more important than he surely ever thought it would be, Marcus, in a ninth inning win over the Braves about a week ago. Yeah, I'm just kind of going back a week just to talk about a little bit about the controversial call at the plate, but more about, does baseball's replay system really work?
It does when it is used with common sense. I don't like replay in any sport for any reason. I think it slows the game. But if you're going to use it, you need to use it judiciously and believe what it shows you. There is no picture showing whether Alec Bohm's big toe touched the plate or not, but it is more likely than not that it didn't. That said, you know, I don't know that you can, if you follow the rules to a T, you can reverse the call, because you need clear evidence to reverse the call, which puts the onus back on the umpire to make the call properly in the first place. And I don't think they did make the call properly, but if replay exists, let's use it commonsensically. And this goes for all replay, hockey, football, basketball, and you shouldn't have limited replays. If you are right on your last replay, you should get another one and another one.
Yeah, and in short, if his toe hadn't been called, if he hadn't been called safe at home plate, then the Phils would have been swept by the Braves, if I'm remembering correctly, right?
Yeah. I believe that's accurate. Yeah. I think that was the winning run, so they might have gone into extra innings.
Yeah.
So probably. Yeah. I mean, but you know, on the flip side, Bryce Harper was called out at third base, what a lot of people think is improperly, earlier that week, I believe. So these things have a way of working themselves out karmically. You know what I mean? The universe adjusts.
You just want the karma to work in your favor, right? Anyway, so the bullpen was horrible last year, but it seems there is hope in 2021.
There is, but for me, it was never as much about the actual bullpen pieces as it was about the starters going deeper. Again, Aaron Nola pitches nine innings in his two previous starts combined before he puts up a complete game shutout. That can't happen. He hadn't pitched through the seventh inning in his first three starts.
Yeah.
A number one pitcher making that kind of money needs to do that.
Mm-hmm.
It really changes your bullpen chemistry. It really changes your bullpen dynamic when you've got three starters who are giving you six plus, you know, 80% of the time. And that's why they get paid. They get paid to keep you in the game deep into games. And earlier when Gabe Kapler was the manager, the bullpen would get taxed because he was a matchup fanatic. That's not the case with Joe Girardi. The bullpen last year was not built to win. They built it with their fingers crossed. This year with Dave Dombrowski, they built the bullpen to win games. Even if they're not going to make the playoffs, they understand they can't waste a year of Bryce Harper, of Zach Wheeler, of Aaron Nola in their primes. They need to be able to win games and have a chance to get into the playoffs.
Yeah. And Kapler, by the way, is back tonight with his San Francisco Giants to start a series at home. So Sixers, Marcus, head of the Nets, I think, by what is it, 1.5 games atop the Eastern Conference, maybe just over a dozen regular season games remaining. Have they faced their most challenging teams? I mean, in your view, is it going to be a challenge, a real challenge, to stay where they are? I mean, I think they've been there pretty much most of the season. What do you think?
I don't know, because everybody is time managing and load managing their best players. I mean, the Nets, I don't think the big three with the Nets, Kevin Durant, James Harden, and Kyrie Irving, have played more than one or two games together, whether through injury or Kyrie just not wanting to play or people being rested, coming off injury, like Kevin Durant's coming off an injury, so he's probably not going to play a lot of back-to-back. So we don't know how good the Sixers are or aren't, but this is good for the Sixers. They don't need to be facing – if you want the Sixers to win, you don't want them to face the Nets at full strength or the Lakers at full strength or the Bucks at full strength. You want them to have a chance to win – with their complete team and a diminished opponent, because that lets the Sixers team, which is a newly formed team, remember, coalesce a little bit more. That's the best case scenario for the Sixers, learning how to, you know, in a sort of a remedial sense, learning how to get Joel Embiid comfortable with double teams, getting Danny Green hot from the corner, getting Seth Curry back into it after his COVID bout, getting Ben Simmons in a position, especially with the newcomer George Hill, who might play in their next game, might play point guard, getting Ben Simmons comfortable playing off the ball. This is the best case scenario for the Sixers, who really haven't coalesced and really haven't faced really good teams in their completeness.
So, and just one more question before we get quickly to the Eagles, Marcus. What exactly is the play-in tournament, which happens during postseason? What is that? That's new, isn't it?
Yes, because of the season's brevity, they're playing 10 fewer games, I believe. They believe that teams won't be able to sort of maximize the stretch run as they often do. Usually there's two or three teams fighting for the last two or three playoff spots. So they're having two extra sort of qualifiers, the ninth and tenth teams. They're having them sort of play in the way that they do in the NCAA tournament to get them sort of off the bubble and not have this sort of like lingering, oh, well, you know, the Sacramento Kings were surging at the end or the Dallas Mavericks were fading at the end, yeah, but they made it anyway. It's a little bit more fair. I don't like it. I think the number of games is the number of games, and you should manage your team and sort of take your lumps injury-wise as you take them. But, again, it also allows teams a little bit of a buffer if they have an injured player or an older player. It allows them to say, okay, we're going to take a chance on losing this game with load management because we'd rather have them more healthy for the playoffs.
All right, to the Eagles, players are joining many others in the league who say they will not attend voluntary on-field workouts this spring. Is this a mistake, especially where younger players are concerned?
Yes.
I mean, it's COVID-related, right?
Well, they say it is, but the reality is most of these guys aren't nearly as responsible in their regular lives as they are when they're being monitored and tested and protocoled by the teams. So the COVID argument to me is silly. What it is a rare attempt by the union, which is incredibly weak, to impress upon the ownership that they don't like adding a 17th game or an 18th game, which will be coming probably within the next 5 years. They think that the players are asked to do too much. There's too much wear and tear. So they're going to do less in the off season that the team controls. But it's not as if these players aren't working out. It's not as if these players are being safer at home than they would be at the facilities. It's ridiculous. They're all working out. They're all being probably less monitored than they would be if they were going into work. And now 18 teams have done it. It's just the union flexing on an issue it knows it can get a little bit of solidarity in, because most players don't live where they play. Most players would much rather stay at home then live in a hotel or go to their off-season, their in-season residence,
sure,
and stay there. It's just a matter of convenience. And yes, it's incredibly irresponsible for the young players. The union is being incredibly irresponsible for the players that make the least amount of money and have the least equity. It's great for older players, but most of the older players sort of show up at OTAs and don't do much anyway. This is just a matter of convenience, and it's an empty gesture. The NFLPA will say, well, look, injuries were down last year. I don't think that was coincidental. I don't think that was causative with the absence of OTAs. That's counterintuitive. The OTAs are supposed to get you in better shape,
yeah,
better prepared to be healthier. All that said, the Eagles, this is the worst possible scenario for the Eagles, who have two new coordinators, a new coaching staff, a wide receiver from last year who missed half his games in Jalen Reagor, and a quarterback last year who started only four games, mm-hmm, in Jalen Hurts. So among
they
their
need the
most
work.
Important players, these guys need a lot, and they have a new coach, a
yeah,
first-time coach.
Yeah.
So it's not like you can look back and say, okay, well, you know, Nick Sirianni did this in Houston. We know what to look for. It's a perfect storm of bad luck for the Eagles, who need these OTAs like no team has ever needed OTAs before. No Eagles team has ever needed OTAs before.
We've got about 30 seconds left, Marcus. Eagles head coach Nick Sirianni, reminds you of Gabe Kapler, as you wrote recently.
He does. I mean, he's so enthusiastic. He's so analytical. He's so sort of hard. It seems plasticky. I think he's real, but I thought Gabe was real too. But it's very hard to digest someone who's kind of overly exuberant and Mr. Catchphrase.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Does it win respect from a bunch of veterans? That's
exactly.
Question.
Yeah. Veterans who are almost his age.
Okay. Well, Marcus, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us. As always, great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
All right. We'll talk soon. Marcus Hayes is a sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Don't forget, if you've missed any part of today's show, our rebroadcast airs at 11 tonight on WHYY. You can also find us at WHYY.org/radio times. Our engineer today has been Al Banks. Our producer is John Ahrens, along with Debbie Builder. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks for listening, and be well.